The Psychology and Cultural Impact of Romantic Obsession. When she was about 30, journalist Lisa Phillips became obsessed with a man who did not share her feelings. Her obsession was so great, it took over her life. Now, some years later, she has taken that experience and made it into the jumping-off point for a book about why people become obsessed. Her book also delves into the historical and cultural basis for this behavior, the psychology behind it, and her own obsessive behavior. The book's title, Unrequited. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss romantic obsession with author Lisa Phillips, as well as with psychotherapist, writer, and teacher Jennifer Noel. When does infatuation become obsession? When does attention and interest turn into something more dangerous, like stalking? And how does narcissism play into the whole idea of romantic obsession? Maine Calling gets to the heart of the matter, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Obsession can often be the stuff of TV melodramas, young adult coming-of-age stories, or in extreme cases, scary tales of stalking. But it is also a very real problem for many people, many of whom don't expect it from themselves. Today, we're going to get a look at the inside world of obsessive love and how to cope with it. Lisa Phillips is an author and journalism professor. A few years back, she found herself in a relationship that she now describes as obsessive on her part. It is the subject of her book, part memoir, part case study, part sociological study, called Unrequited. She joins us from a studio in Woodstock, New York. With me in our Portland studio, Jennifer Noel. She's a psychotherapist, writer, and teacher from Brunswick. She has written about infatuation and worked with many clients around this issue. She leads personal growth and writing workshops and teaches psychology at Southern Maine Community College. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been in an obsessive relationship or known someone who has? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both so much for being here on Maine Calling today. And Lisa Phillips, I think it was very brave of you to reveal your own story, including your own pretty horrible behavior. Why did you choose to expose yourself like that?
Well, first of all, I should say that this occurred 17 years ago, so I'm very much beyond it. And I think that situation made it more safe to recount what happened to me. And I also think that even though absolutely my behavior got out of hand, in most ways, it's something a lot of people go through when they become infatuated with someone and they just can't shake it. And it literally takes over their minds and changes them in ways that are often very uncomfortable. So it felt like from the distance of the years that maybe I could make a difference by sharing my story and sharing it as someone who solidly has her sane credentials in order. I'm a working woman, a mom, a wife, all kinds of normal things. This was not a ruinous obsession, though it got a little intense at times.
When you say it took over your behavior, for those listeners who have not read your book, what was sort of the apex? When did you know it had gone too far?
Basically, what happened was I started spending a lot of time with a former classmate, someone I'd been in a graduate school seminar with. And this was right after a man that I'd been getting pretty serious with dumped me unexpectedly. So I was really in mourning for this relationship, and hanging out with the man I call B was very soothing for a while and also very enlivening. I enjoyed not having a relationship with him, but I very much hoped that I one day would. And he was seeing someone else. It was a long-distance relationship, and he kept hinting, oh, we'll break up. This isn't going to last very long. And then it became clear that that relationship wasn't going to end. And then that's when I got really obsessed. To the point where I couldn't stop thinking about him. I would shadow him. We worked in the same building, so I knew his habits and would try to watch him pass whenever possible. And then one morning, this was after a kind of back and forth. Once again, he said, oh, I think we're finally going to break up, and then they didn't. I just woke up one morning and I thought, this is ridiculous. This man should be with me. So I walked to his apartment a few blocks away, got someone to let me in the security door, and went up to his apartment and banged on the door. hoping that he would see that as the grandest of romantic gestures. But he opened it holding a baseball bat to ward me off, with a phone in the other hand, dialing 911, a call he didn't complete, but nonetheless, obviously, he felt very threatened about what I was doing, and it was really the opposite, in his eyes, of the grand romantic gesture. So that was really the pinnacle of it all.
Jennifer Noel, how common is this? How common is it for somebody to cross that line between infatuation and obsession?
Oh, I think it's really very common. It's something I see a lot in my office and just among, you know, the people that I know. I've kind of made a study of it my whole life because I was such an obsessed teenager. So it's something I've looked for and seen very often.
What is, in your view, the line, Jennifer, between infatuation and obsession, like a teenage crush and obsession? When do you know you've gone too far?
Well, I think it becomes obsession when you can't get it out of your head, when you wake up thinking about it and you go to sleep thinking about it and it distracts you from what you want to be doing. If you're a teenager, you know, maybe you need to be doing your homework and you just want to listen to music and fantasize about this person that you're obsessed with. And as far as going too far, I guess that sort of depends on the situation, but certainly when you can't get it out of your mind and you want to, that's a problem.
Lisa, it's interesting to me that you said you thought you were making a grand romantic gesture by breaking into this man's apartment building and banging on his door, because in your book you explore that there's some cultural support for these grand romantic gestures. You say pop culture sides overwhelmingly with unrequited love, that this idea of being really obsessed with someone and making these grand gestures is something that's supported in song and in movies and TV shows. So we're getting mixed messages, aren't we?
We are, and it really just depends on what's happening on the other end. So think about John Cusack in Say Anything, that famous scene where he's holding the boombox and playing the song, the Peter Gabriel song. And that is, in that case, a very beautiful romantic moment. But at the same time, if he hadn't been wanted, it would not have been. You know, it would have been creepy as anything. And so it really depends on what's happening with the other person in so many cases. And when the obsessed person stops listening to those cues and just thinks of the grand romantic gesture and what it will do for them, you know, as I was thinking, then there's that disconnect. And that's when it becomes really very narcissistic instead of romantic.
And that's something really interesting in your book, that you say romantic obsession is really narcissism. Explain that.
Yeah, that's something that was really intriguing to explore, because look, the way we frame it in our own minds is that, you know, this is where we're martyring ourselves to love. We're doing it all for love. It's all about the other person. But when you really think about it, when that other person doesn't respond, it's all about the self, and you're asking that other person to complete you in some way. And we think of narcissists as very self-absorbed, grandiose people who actually can't love and can't care. But then there's this flip side of narcissism, and the thing it has in common is the other person completes me. But narcissism can also be very needy and seemingly self-subjugating. Finding out that narcissism was so integrally involved in this dynamic was really important, because it just changes that dynamic. If you talk to someone, I'm sure Jennifer can attest to this, when you talk to someone who is romantically obsessed, they will tell you on and on and on what is wrong with the other person. And they don't want to turn that lens toward themselves. And I was certainly guilty of that in my obsession with B. It was all about something's holding him back. He really does love me. This relationship he's in is wrong for him. And I could say that until I turned blue. But it didn't make a difference in the end. Even if he did have some feelings for me, and there were hints that he did, he couldn't reciprocate. He just was not in a position to reciprocate. Yet I still had a narrative in my head that insisted that he must, that it was good not for me, but also for him, that my unrequited love was the visionary and true force. And that is a very self-absorbed way of thinking.
Jennifer, it must be hard for clients to face that in themselves, to have a suggestion that you need to take a harder look at yourself.
Oh, so hard, because they are so transfixed by the story that they're in. And it's, as a therapist, it's hard not to sometimes get drawn into the story as well, because they come in and they want to tell you every whip stitch of information that's happened, and they want to complain. And I mean, I'm the same when I'm in an obsessed situation. We all are. And it's hard for people to get to that moment where they say, what can I do? What can I do to change the situation, because I'm in so much pain? That's a tough leap to make.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about romantic obsession. Jennifer Noel, I wanted to ask you, at the very beginning you said you've had a lifelong interest in this because you were such an obsessed teenager. For those of us who are the mothers or grandmothers or grandfathers of teenage girls, give us some guidance as young women begin to feel romantic feelings. And then, I mean, some of the things you described, playing music and pining for someone, that seems about as American as apple pie. I mean, what kind of guidance as parents and teachers and counselors can you give those of us who've hopefully come out on the other side?
That's such a great question, and something that I've thought about an awful lot. I should say that Lisa addresses this beautifully in her book. There's so much good stuff about this particular issue, what it means.
I'd love to weigh in when you're done.
Okay,
great. Yeah,
what it means for girls
and
their power and expressing their power by pursuing someone, and how it can be an empowering thing. But as a mom, myself of two teenage girls, I think about this a lot, and looking for the information from the kid to help her understand what it is she's looking for. She's probably not really just looking to obtain this boy or girl that she's obsessed with. What does she actually need? She probably needs more self-esteem, more ways to spend her time, and to really help her disengage perhaps from the obsession is a very helpful thing, as opposed to getting caught up in it yourself, which we who are interested in romance could very well do, wanting to hear the story from the girl and what did he say to you today, and you know, but not to get pulled into that, but to see what she can do for herself to build her self-esteem.
Lisa.
Thanks so much. I have a daughter who's 11, and she doesn't have crushes yet, and I don't know if she'll admit it when she does because of what her mom writes about, but I was very concerned about this topic. I thought, oh my God, this is going to start happening to her. And what I found out actually is really encouraging, because crushes are much better for kids than real relationships, especially in the younger years of adolescence, when early dating actually has a very negative impact on things like grades, school performance, premarital pregnancy rates, all those kinds of things. Crushes don't have those risks. They can still be incredibly painful, but they're just such an opportunity for parents, if your child will open up at all about a crush situation. It's an opportunity for your child to assess values. It's an opportunity for your child to rehearse desire without the real risks of engaging in a mutual relationship. And it's also, there's a phenomenon that I found fascinating, and it plays out both in adolescents and adults. And it's called an identity crush. You want someone because you want to be like them. This can be scary, you know, if your daughter has a crush on the bad boy or something like that. But it can also be very much a sign of all kinds of yearning. I mean, even that crush on the bad boy says something maybe about the constraints she's facing in her life and a need for a little bit of freedom and ways to test that freedom. And there could very well be some safe or liberating ways to do that. In my case, my first huge crush was on someone I met at summer camp, and he was from New York City, and he read widely. He quoted Freud in conversation. His father was an agent for a classical violinist. He lived this life of the mind and ideas. And I had, I think when I was a kid, wanted to be like that. But as a teen, I found myself becoming much more superficial. And this crush on David really brought me back to that yearning I had to be involved in the world of ideas and to be well-read. And it changed the course of my life. I can honestly say, even though the crush itself was intensely painful and frustrating and at times depressing, it still changed me in ways that I value still.
Well, believe it or not, we have to take a break. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions for Lisa Phillips and Jennifer Noel. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Maine Medical Center, getting people back to where they belong, home. Learn more at mainemedicalcenter.org and Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainer's success, famemaine.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the legacy of the 1947 partition of India that created Pakistan. We talk with journalist Nased Hajjari about the violence that surrounded the partition, why those tensions persist today, and how they've led to Pakistan's support for extremist groups like the Taliban. Hajjari's new book is Midnight Furies. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. MPBN Television provides a quality mix of relevant, informative, and trusted news, cultural, and children's programs, and that's just our main primary HD channel. We also have two additional digital channels, World and Create. World explores our world through programs like the NewsHour, Nova, and many others. Create includes many of the best-known cooking, carpentry, travel, gardening, painting, and craft programs. Both the World and Create are available over the air and on many of Maine's cable companies' digital tiers. If you'd like more information about World or Create, including how to find them, see your experience member guide, visit mpbn.net and click on television or call MPBN Audience Services.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Romantic Obsession. With me in the studio, Jennifer Noel. She's a psychotherapist, writer, and teaches psychology at Southern Maine Community College. With us from a studio in Woodstock, New York, Lisa Phillips. She's the author of Unrequited, Women in Romantic Obsession. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jennifer, are there people who are more prone, more apt to sort of be vulnerable to obsession, romantic obsession than others?
Yeah, I think so. A couple of different things come to mind. In terms of types of people, I think we talk about people who have different kinds of attachment styles. We all have a different kind of attachment style, how we attach to other people. And some are said to have what's called an anxious attachment style. So whenever they find themselves feeling attached to someone, it's really not easy. There's a lot of like wondering about the relationship and always looking for evidence that things are okay. And I think that person is more likely to get very concerned about what's happening in the relationship, and even maybe try to attach to somebody where the other person isn't giving them a lot of feedback. The other thing that I would consider is folks who have had a lot of difficulty in childhood around maybe abusive parenting or a lot of breaks in their relationships, which could lead to an anxious attachment style. They may be looking really hard for somebody to make them feel safe and secure, and yet they're used to being with people who aren't really tuned into them.
And Lisa, what do you find about when people are vulnerable at what phases in their life? Are there times in your life or things that will happen that
that maybe put you in a place that you might not be otherwise?
That's a fantastic question, because I'm someone who was very fortunate to have great parents and a fairly stable upbringing, and that made me feel like, wait, how did I go so far off the rails with, you know, such a secure background? I think phase of life is very key. I think for me, I was at a very lost time in my life where the effort I was putting into things, such as finding a lasting love relationship and my career, the effort wasn't, it was a time where it wasn't clear how that effort was going to pay off. And frankly, at the time, it didn't seem that it was paying off at all. So I think that was a factor. And I think another thing that can be hugely important and a little more flexible in terms of people with different attachment styles, even healthier attachment styles coming into this problem, is that when you put great value on something, and there can be all kinds of reasons to do this, when you sort of hook a goal that's very, very important in your life to a particular person, you can get into this very entrenched place where you can't see that the person is not helping you reach that goal, and that the linkage, the goal linking, is not an appropriate one. So, for example, if you somehow say that I can't feel good about myself unless I have this person, you're linking the goal of healthy self-esteem to a very particular individual, which is something that no one out there really deserves, even a spouse, you know. It's something that has to come through more inner work. But surely many times when people become obsessed, this can very much be the case. And then there's just sheer level of emotional investment. You know, people who are in marriages that last for a very long time, and then suddenly a spouse is out the door because of an affair or a kind of sudden decision, there's a very genuine panic there of, oh my God, my life is falling apart. And that can drive people to become very obsessed with figuring how to get that love back.
Lisa Phillips is the author of Unrequited. A quick programming note, Lisa will be speaking about her book this Friday from noon to one at the Portland Public Library. Going to Bob in Bangor. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes, hi. This program is totally illuminating and totally fascinating. And anybody who's had an experience like what they're describing would be captivated. But, and I'd like to give you my experience of something like this. It happened 25 years apart, two different episodes of my life, and it illustrates a lot of the points that have been brought up. I mean, the two experiences, and it happened 25 years apart, roughly. The first one was in my early 20s, when I had not had a fully formed identity yet, and part of that, of course, was not having much, good deal of self-esteem. And I met this woman who seemed so captivating and superior that she just swept me away, and I found myself in a couldn't help myself feeling the way I did, but unfortunately for me, she didn't see things that way. She saw me more or less as someone who needed to be shepherded and, you know, guided or something like that, you know, be my mentor. But I wanted more than that, and of course, it just became an all-consuming, futile exercise. And it took, I don't even know when I realized what the truth about it all was, that it was really me who was the answer. I mean, you have to do the self-examination. So, but 25 years later, so it was a matter of narcissistic self-completion and reaching out and not getting it, you know. I mean, and it is true that all romantic love is obsession. It's just that in some cases it's required and sometimes it's not, but it's the same kind of phenomenon. If two people are obsessed with each other, then it's going to go well. And then 25 years later, the second woman, this is after a long period of obviously, 25 years later, I was a different person, and I was mature, and I did have good self-esteem at this point, and was looking to find somebody not to really complete myself, but to complement myself. And I found that person, and it seemed entirely reasonable to me that she would feel the same way as I did about her, that we would have a relationship, we would love each other. But and it didn't happen, and I thought, what's going on here? This is just insane. That this person, because the person was so much like myself, I thought that this affair should happen, would happen, has to happen. But and even though she recognized that too, it seemed impossible for her to reciprocate. And then the freedom from all this came about 6 months later, I guess, And it is true that you wake up every day and you cannot think of anything else. And especially in this case, where it just seemed that it is entirely irrational for her to behave the way, in the non-responding way that she was. How can this be?
How did you free yourself from that, Bob?
By realizing that that even though we were the similar people, and my perception was that therefore we should have the same perception of each other, whereas I liked myself, she didn't. So how could she possibly want to have a deep an affair with me if she truly didn't like herself? Recognizing
so,
that,
oh, so,
that we are.
Go ahead, Lisa.
And that's when I felt free from everything. And I mean the emotional.
So you decided something was wrong with her. That's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
you know that she didn't feel good enough about herself.
Thing that was going on 25 years earlier, and you know, after it's all over, you just have to. The only way you can unearth yourself from something like this is by humor. The psychotherapist is just there to listen to your story. They have no other utility. That's too bad, but that's really true. That they cannot do a thing to help you, in my opinion. You have to have time and a sense of humor, and thanks for the show.
You're welcome, Bob. Let's give our guests a chance to respond. Lisa.
That's so fascinating, Bob, and thank you for sharing your story. And I think what was so interesting about the second story is that it illustrates the power of narrative and our cognitions about the world. You had a narrative. You were ready. You had good self-esteem. In walks this woman. You have a lot in common. You're ready to love. And unfortunately, she wasn't. She didn't fit your narrative. And that narratives can be very powerful. There's this whole thing called the script of unrequited love. You know, I desire this thing for a reason, and I should get what I deserve. And so it sounded like what happened. She could very well have had a problem inside herself that left her unable to love. But really, the sheer fact of the matter was she just couldn't return your love. And whenever I talk to people, I'm not a therapist myself, but the research for this book has given me some, at least some information to give back to people, certainly not counseling. You know, one thing I always say is, in the end, that's the only truth you know. That person couldn't give you what you wanted. And it sounds like something inside of yourself finally acknowledged that. You had an explanation for it, but that explanation helped set you free. And that really is the most important part.
Jennifer, do you have thoughts?
A little bit around the notion that it should have been perfect. What's the problem? And when it's all said and done, you know, you have more insight about it. But it's still possible to have insight about ourselves too, even when it turns out that it's really the other person, so to speak. It's still possible to say, well, what was it about me where I fell in love with somebody who wasn't available to me? Is there something going on that I want to understand better about myself?
Bob, thanks so much for calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Lisa, one of the things you explore in your book is this idea that people try harder or become more obsessed, the motivational paradox that something with someone they are less likely to obtain. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a motivational paradox, right? Because you love someone who's not loving you back. So all the benefits of being in love are not coming your way. And there are a number of things that explain it. But before I go into that, I think what's really important is another phenomenon called frustration attraction. That's a term that Helen Fisher, the biological anthropologist out of Rutgers University, coined. And that's when something is denied to you, you reject it, or an advance is not reciprocated, you sometimes increase your efforts to, or at least feel like increasing your efforts to win the person over. And evolutionary psychologists talk about this is in part because when someone has the freedom to reject us, their value is goes up in our eyes. They must be a high value person if they can, you know, pick and choose who they're going to be with. And I think the other thing I would add about the motivational paradox is that there can be very specific reasons. The three reasons given in the research are that you value the person highly, so you keep going, even if you're not getting the benefits of reciprocated love. Also, you feel like you have a chance of winning the person. Something about his or her behavior is indicating, okay, maybe he'll come around. And then the third thing is fascinating, which is that there's something about the state of being in unrequited love that is beneficial to you. It allows you to play a role. It allows you to invest a lot in fantasy. It may allow you to be creatively or professionally inspired, kind of like Don Quixote was when he went off in search of his Dulcinea on his famous journey in the novel. So those are the things that lie behind the motivational paradox.
Interesting. We have a Facebook post from Barry. She says, you have three women discussing this and referencing daughters. As a woman who's been the object of crushes and later in life stalked by males, please address this as a multi-gender concern. And Lisa, you do that very much in your book. We have been talking mainly about women because your book is Unrequited. Is called Unrequited Women in Romantic Obsession. But one of the things you talk about is that throughout history, or even in our own current popular culture, there seems to be a flipping of what's okay for men and women. It's not okay for a man to be obsessed. It's not okay for a man to stalk. That's considered dangerous. But somehow, if a woman does that same behavior, it's sometimes they get a pass.
Yeah, it's what I call the gender pass. And that was one of the reasons I decided to focus on women. I feel we understand women and romantic pursuit and romantic obsession not as well as we understand men. As you put it, we know how to read them when they're scary and how to read them when they're, you know, just trying a little harder and being more romantic or chivalrous in the tradition of courtly love. But I think that the Facebook post, the concerns of that are very valid. I'm so sorry to hear that you've been stalked, the person who posted. That's a horrible, horrible experience. And the book does look at the issue of victims of unwanted romantic pursuit and stalking, and how horrible it can be. Because in many ways, we have sympathy for stalking victims, but there's so much that we don't understand about romantic pursuit that sometimes, as a culture, we get confused and we think, for example, we'll blame the victim and say, well, what did you do to cause this? The kind of thinking that is often touted or often described as rape culture thinking. So the Facebook poster must have had a very difficult time with that. And I do talk to targets and victims of stalking about their side of the story and how confusing it can be to try to work this through and figure this out and know how to treat the situation and know how to reject someone without feeling guilt about it, which often accompanies being the target.
The phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions, including Sarah in Portland. Please stay with us.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Broadcasting's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life. And the Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, committed to regaining mobility and getting rid of the pain. JointsME.org.
Wednesday on Morning Edition, the second part of Susan Sharon's look into a grievance system that many say is failing Maine prison inmates. I'm Erwin Gratz. I'll have the day's other news with plenty of help from NPR and the BBC. Lou McNally will have details about our weather forecast, and we bring you the Marketplace Morning Report, too. Join us for Morning Edition, 6 to 9 a.m. Wednesday here on Maine Public Radio.
And join us this afternoon following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker, David Brooks. He'll discuss his new book, The Road to Character. At the Commonwealth Club of California, coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Understanding and Addressing Obsessive Love. With me in the studio, Jennifer Noel, psychotherapist, writer, and teacher from Brunswick. Joining us from a studio in Woodstock, New York, Lisa A. Phillips, author of Unrequited: Women and Romantic Obsession. She is also the author of Public Radio, Behind the Voices. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to head now to Portland and Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I want to say it's just an honor to be able to speak with you all. It's wonderful to know that there are such great professionals here in the state of Maine. My question is, using a romantic relationship as a motivator to get an individual in their early 20s to get a job, move out of the house, have a good life, those sort of things, I feel like it's a dangerous road. But if that's the only motivator that the individual is willing to disclose of or talk about, how to go around that and how to work with that individual to maybe use the possibility of a romantic relationship, but find a way to use it as an intrinsic motivator rather than an extrinsic, I guess is my question.
Jennifer?
Go ahead, Lisa. Gosh, that's such a complicated situation, and all kinds of things come to mind when you talk about that. You have to play a very, I would imagine, very difficult or walk a very difficult road here, because you don't want to say, get your life together so you can make a home with this person who may or may not reciprocate. But by the same token, romantic obsession is a tremendous motivator. So if you can discuss, and I'm assuming this is a friend or perhaps a child or a younger person in your life, if you can get that person to discuss what's on the other side of this, you know, you want to get out of the house, you want to be able to share your life with someone, I think that you could probably help that person separate. Okay, they're obsessed with someone, so they want to be able to have more independence. Those two goals, you can kind of separate out and say, you know what, you may not get the object of your affection once you're out there and independent. But being out there and independent will do so much for your sense of self that it may open the door to even better things in your life, like having that sense of self-esteem that comes from being financially independent and out on your own. So I don't think it has to be a bad thing that these two things come together, as long as you can talk about them as two separate goals.
I think I would need to understand a little bit more about the question in order to, but I would mirror what Lisa said.
Sarah, thanks for your call. I want to move on to the idea that you do address in your book, Lisa, of the connection between what happens to your brain when you're feeling obsessed. That this is not, there are actually chemical changes, and I don't want to put too many words into your mouth. I'd rather have you explain it.
Well, first of all, the brain in love is a brain in a state very akin to addiction. And we now are starting to talk about passionate love as an addiction, a very good addiction. Again, I'll quote Helen Fisher, when it's going well, but a really painful addiction when it's not going well. So what you'll see in the brain is that several of the same areas of the brain that function in addiction also function in passionate love. There's an increase in the areas of the brain that manufacture dopamine, which is the neurotransmitter that's most commonly associated with energy, focus, craving, motivation, all kinds of things. And then another phenomenon is that there's a decrease in serotonin. This is something that also happens in addiction, and that can make us feel nervous and jittery. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter that we regulate when we're giving people medication for depression and anxiety. So it is a very kind of fraught brain state. Other things happen, such as the area of the brain that makes you afraid. The activity decreases in that area. And then when you're rejected in love, or someone you love doesn't love you back, all these things get heightened. So the dopamine manufacturing centers of the brain, they get even more activated. It's like you're even more in love. But then a few other things happen as well, such as the area of your brain associated with assessing gains and losses becomes very, very active. And so you're thinking, how can I fix this? How can I fix this? Which is a state that has been discussed as one that could make people particularly open to a counseling or therapy process because they're really trying to figure things out. So it's a number of processes, but it's a really intense brain state. And you're yearning and you're craving because you really are feeling all the things that people feel when they're addicted to a substance.
Jennifer, the treatments for obsession often similar for other addictive behaviors?
Oh, I would say so, yes. The person first needs to recognize that there is some addiction here, you know, when they're in this obsessed state. And that can be hard because the word addiction is big and has a lot of stigma. But once they sort of buy into that idea that, wait, this is a lot like an addiction, then there's more opportunity for treatment. And by the same token, a lot of times people aren't ready to look at treating their obsessive issue as an addiction until they, quote, hit rock bottom. They have to have an experience, which maybe Lisa could describe in her experience, but where they're like, oh, my God, no, I cannot do this anymore. This isn't working. This is humiliating, whatever it is. And then they can get some help. There could be medication can be helpful, like Lisa mentioned, to regulate moods in the brain. But there's a lot else that needs to happen, like addressing the addictive process, not just about the obsession about the person, but the addictive process. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be very helpful for any addictive or obsessive behavior, like doing things that distract and break the connections in your mind, exercise, things like that that would really take your mind in a different way. Support groups, I want to mention Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous is a really helpful support group for people who kind of chronically get involved in obsessive relationships and find that they can't stop. If they're not obsessed with one person, they're obsessed with someone else.
Interesting. We have a tweet. This person asks, are there warning signs regarding becoming obsessed? Lisa?
I don't know. It just kind of takes you over. But I think what you want to be thinking about with romantic obsession, and this came up earlier in the program as well, is how much is it interfering with your daily functioning? And it's very hard to see when it is. But when you're on the other side of it and deeply in it, you know, you're going to eventually have to say to yourself, I'm not able to work and I'm not able to sleep and I'm not eating the way I should and all these other things and face up to it. So warning sign, you know, I don't know. It's hard because you could be just thinking like so many people think when they're starting a relationship that does turn out to be mutual. I'm falling in love. You know, this is great. This is wonderful. You know, I'm figuring out how this person feels about me. It's looking good. I see some signs. You could be thinking and feeling all these sort of normal, loving things, and then suddenly something happens and you realize you're deep, deep in, and the other person absolutely is not. So I think it just takes that regular work we all have to do in all facets of life, which is to try to be as self-aware as possible. I'd love to hear what Jennifer has to say about this.
The warning signs. I think you can also, we've talked a little bit about what are the conditions that a person can be in when she falls victim, so to speak, to romantic obsession. And I think people who are in transition and feeling lost, and, you know, maybe a person who has been unhappy for a long time or felt stuck, and then all of a sudden somebody breaks through that feeling, and you meet this person, you think, I feel alive again, you know. And if you hear that, you know, hear your friend talking about, oh, my God, all of a sudden I felt alive again, and they've been in a rough spot, that might be a time when things get out of control.
Lisa, one of the things that was interesting to me in your book is that you tell so many stories of different people who have fallen into romantic obsession in different ways. But in so many of those stories, there was a friend who said, you've got to knock this off. You've got to dump that guy. You've got to get out of this relationship. Is listening to your friends maybe a pretty good tip?
It is. And I think overall, we want to emphasize the importance of social attachments that are not romantic, because they're your landing pad. You know, whenever someone talks to me about a relationship they think is ending or is not rewarding or is not reciprocated, I ask them about who else is in their life. I say, okay, if this doesn't work out, who's your landing pad? Who's going to be around you? Get those people around you, because a good deal of that sort of neurochemical chaos that happens, social attachments of other kinds can really help. They don't fix everything, but they really, really help, because they're supplying some of those, you know, comforting feelings that you need to offset the anxiety and the yearning that you're feeling.
Jennifer, do you agree with her? And do you believe that it's a good idea to turn to others if you're questioning your own behavior?
Definitely. Others, when you're ready to hear from other people, they can be the best, you know, mirror for your behavior. Like, whoa, you've gone too far, you know, and you may not be able to see that until somebody tells you.
All right. Well, we just have a couple minutes. Any final thoughts, both Lisa Phillips and Jennifer Noel, on recognizing and helping avoid obsessive behavior?
One thing I do want to sneak in is that, you know, unrequited love is not always a bad thing. There are countless stories in our history, you know, people like Dante, Mary Wollstonecraft, great artists and writers and figures in our history who have been inspired by experiences, very difficult experiences of unrequited love. And that's something that's very real, too. So we don't have a lot of time to explore that end of it, but I just want to flag that as something that can be very powerful in a good way for people if they can gain the necessary distance from what's happening to them to channel that energy into another direction.
Yeah, if you can take that same energy that you're using to focus on the other person and turn it toward yourself and think about what is it that I'm missing here that this person represents, you may find that you've got a whole bunch of information you can work with.
All right. Well, Jennifer Noel and Lisa Phillips, thank you so much for being here. Lisa Phillips is the author of Unrequited: Women and Romantic Obsession. Jennifer Noel is a psychotherapist and writer from Brunswick. Don't forget that Lisa will be speaking about her book from noon to 1 p.m. at the Portland Public Library. John Keimel ran the board and Tommy Bazarian answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. While there, sign up for the podcast, which is also available on iTunes. If you enjoyed today's program, consider sharing it. There is a link on our webpage that makes sharing our programs quick and easy. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, Life Inside Prison, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation with a former prison guard and a former prisoner turned prisoner advocate. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.